on the whole, I think we have had a very fortunate escape, and a very great reason to return our humble and hearty thanks to Almighty God for preserving and delivering so many of us from our more savage enemies. Admiral Benedict Arnold. Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast. This is episode 63, The Escape. So it's about 2 weeks. Got a little hung up on my pre-Thanksgiving break school schedule, parent-teacher conferences and the like. Was not able to get a episode out too quickly at the end of last week, nor at the beginning of this week. So I'm doing one today, and I will hopefully have one done that I can do this weekend so that I can kind of make up that time that I missed. Last week we ended with 2 weeks ago, we ended with Valcour Island. And I left off talking about how Benedict Arnold was planning his escape. Now, they had fought all day, or for most of the day, about 6 hours of stiff, hard battle. The fleet is battered. The ships are torn apart. They're very low on ammunition. Arnold needs to figure out a way to escape. He calls his council of war. They agree. We need to get out. But the question was, where were they going to go? Because they had limited options available to them. He put the fleet in a bay. But there was an escape route. They did have a way to get out. If they go to the north, there was a channel that could lead to the top of the island. They'd come around the island, be in open water, and they could make their escape. The only problem was is going north would put them in that same wind that was keeping the British outside the bay. So if the escape took too long in the night, then they would be coming up on the British fleet by morning, and then the fight would resume all over again. Secondly, what happens if they can't negotiate that channel? What if some of the larger ships get stuck? Then the ships behind them are stuck. So they're not going to be able to make their escape effectively from this channel. Arnold sees that there is really only one choice. He's got to go through the British fleet. Pringle had put himself in a position that left a gap to the west side of to the western shore. So his men were stacked up in open water. There was a small space between the west bank and the British fleet that the ships could pass through pretty easily as long as they kept themselves quiet. They waited till about 8 p.m. Colonel Edwards Wigglesworth aboard the Trumbull was given the distinct honor of being the first one to head through this gap in the British line. Following him were the gondolas. Behind the gondolas would be the sailing vessels. And behind the sailing vessels were the Washington and the Congress. Now, the ships were able to make good time getting out. They did whatever the best they could to patch up their sails and rigging. They put canvas over the oars so that they kind of muffled the sound of the oars in the water. And they made sure all orders were given in quiet. So this was everything that the Americans can do to keep, you know, themselves quiet so they didn't alert attention to the British. But any of us that ever been out at night, there is light that comes down. You know, you're not standing in pitch dark, you know, where you can't see 5 feet in front of you. They would be able to see the ships going, so why didn't they react? There's two reasons why historians think that they were able to make their escape. The first was, well, if you look at some of the astronomy charts from that time, it seems to be that there was a moonless night. A new moon cycle was happening, which means that the moon was either a very thin crescent-shaped or there was no moon at all. So that would automatically take a lot of light away from that area. The second was, remember, the Royal Savage is on fire. And with the Royal Savage burning, all out of that extra residual light is kind of keeping night vision from the British guards, or at least keeping them from effectively seeing in night vision what's going on. So they don't notice that the Americans have made their escape. Of course, it must have been some sort of surprise to the British that, oh, hey, We wake up the next morning and those 15 American vessels, gone. Just disappeared. And through the night, the American oarsmen aboard the gondolas and the cutters and even on the sailing vessels work through the night to try and make sure that the ships could create as much space between them as possible. Arnold wanted to have as much distance between him and the Royal Navy that he could possibly have to ensure the fleet's successful escape. The only problem was that sometime in the night, the wind shifted. And the wind that was keeping the British from going into the bay turned to the south and was actually blowing in the faces of the Americans. So the oarsmen are working extra hard for not as much distance. They're trying to work as hard as they can to, you know, create that space between themselves and the British fleet, but they're just not able to do it. And so by the next morning, most of the American fleet has only gotten to Schuyler Island, which was about 10 miles south of Valcour Island, and this took them 12 hours to do it. The Trumbull, who had a little bit of a lead on the rest of the fleet, had a little bit more time of effective wind. Also, her sail wasn't as battered as some of the others. So when she gets down there, she actually makes it to Linganore Point, which was 6 miles south of Schuyler Island. So she made 16 miles in that 12-hour time frame, which isn't bad. So it's there that Wigglesworth will decide to wait, and he's going to rest his men, make as many repairs as possible, and wait for the rest of the fleet. While the rest of the fleet will anchor at Schuyler Island. The sailing vessels arrive first, followed by the rowing ships, the gondolas. The Congress will make it there pretty quickly. The last one to arrive was the Washington. She was so shot up in the fight that during the retreat, much of the rigging and sails gave out that she actually had to be 100% rowed to Schuyler Island. So her men on that vessel come in really exhausted. Once the fleet is at anchor, Arnold will send word to Gates about the battle, the state of the fleet. He reports that his intention is to return to Crown Point. He needs ammo sent there and a dozen well-manned bateaux in case the wind keeps up. Then the ships, some of the ships at least, might have to be rowed in to Crown Point. So he needs those things sent there immediately. Arnold doesn't want to linger in his current position. He just wants to stop the leaks on the ships, fix the sails as best he can, and get underway. He can already see the British reacting to his absence at Valcour Island and already starting to get underway and get on the move. So it's going to take a little bit of time. The men need to rest. So by the afternoon, the sailing vessels will take off. This is the afternoon of the 12th, by the way, if you couldn't figure out. Battle was on the 11th. By the afternoon of the 12th, the sailing ships will head towards Linganore Point to join the Trumbull. At various intervals, other ships are going to take off. Arnold and the Congress would leave about 2 p.m. The gondolas were all leaving at various points throughout the day. The Washington would be bringing up the rear. She would leave sometime around sunset because there was just that much work that needed to be done on the vessel. The British fleet was following, but the same wind that hampered the Americans through the night was also keeping them from making good time on the battered American fleet. Now, if the wind changes and once again starts blowing from the north, the Americans are not going to be able to keep their lead. Their men are exhausted. They've been awake for over 30 hours now. Six of those were spent fighting, and the rest of it was manning oars and sails. The gondolas were in the roughest shape. They were lightly built, and with damage from the battle, they were coming apart. Sometime during the night of the 12th, the Spitfire sank. With the British closing in, they had abandoned three other gondolas. On the morning of the 13th, the weather saw a change for the better. The wind started to blow from the north. This, of course, like I said, would help the American fleet, but now the British are gaining on the beat-up ships. And eventually, they're going to catch up to the American fleet. In the afternoon of the 13th, the British will catch up to the American fleet and start firing on the vessels. The Washington almost gives up immediately. Her men are exhausted, her sails torn apart, the mast is falling apart, the ship is just beat up. There's little to no ammo left. The captain gives up and says, "I surrender," and he will move the ship to the shore and as many of his men to try and take to the woods as they can before the British take the vessel. Not so much for the Congress. Arnold, seeing an opportunity here, turns and starts to fight. He's going to turn and he's going to lay it, wreak havoc on the British fleet. Now, he has lighter guns, so he's not heavily damaging these ships, but the fact is that four British ships will surround the Congress. The Inflexible, the Maria, the Carlton, and the Loyal Convert will surround the Congress and will be firing shots at it all for that entire 2.5 hours. And so, unfortunately, though Arnold was welcoming the fight, many of the other vessels were struggling to just get out of the way and would be caught up in the running battle, especially the gondolas. Many of the ships would make for the shore, abandoning or burning the vessels as they could and then taking to the woods. The Congress slogged it out continuously with the British for as long as she could. She was returning fire, but she was outnumbered and outgunned. Arnold ran the ship ashore and tried to set fire to her, but it didn't take, and then took to the woods. He was going to march back to Crown Point with his men on foot. The only ships that would actually survive the escape were the Trumbull, who had a nice lead, the Revenge, the Enterprise, and the Liberty, which were sailing vessels, not needing oar power. They were also the Liberty and the Enterprise were ships for wounded. They didn't do a lot of the fighting, so they weren't actually all that beat up either. And the New York, which was the only surviving gondola. It actually, funny story, she was originally named Success before they renamed her the New York. So I guess she, in the end, actually lives up to her name. The only reason that those ships were able to survive was because Pringle breaks off the attack by the evening. A questionable call, but by all intents and purposes, he destroyed the fleet. A couple of ships got away. He still has 20 gunboats, the Inflexible, the Maria, the Carlton, the Loyal Convert, and the Thunderer is still floating around somewhere back up north. Though she couldn't, you know, do a lot of sailing, she will still be a usable ship. Not to mention that they capture the Washington and put her to work. They capture several gondolas, put them to work. Even the Congress, because the fire didn't take, was taken and put to use for the British fleet. So they captured all of these vessels. So in Pringle's mind, it's evening. We're getting up close to the American lines. I don't want to get too close to their forts because if they have heavy guns waiting for us, well, the ships will be okay, but what about the men on the gunboats? At least that's my thinking. At least that's what I'm thinking is going through his head. So the American fleet has been destroyed. 3.5 months after its inception, Benedict Arnold's navy is gone. Arnold, who left a few weeks ago from Crown Point at the head of a fleet, would be returning on foot. When he got there, they got as much of the supplies out as they could, the garrison left, and burned Crown Point before they retreated. Now, with that fort gone, the last American stronghold in the Hudson area, or the Hudson River area, would be Fort Ticonderoga. Carleton, not wanting to risk a frontal attack on the fort, he thought the best thing that he could do was to lay a siege. What's going through Carleton's head at this point? The Americans are sick. They got smallpox in camp. Their fleet has been destroyed. They're not going to be able to hold the fort. He doesn't know that. He sees Fort Ticonderoga. He knows the story of Abercrombie's failed attempt to take the fort in 56 during the French and Indian War. There is no way that he is going to be able to do this close to winter. And with the amount of soldiers that he has, he's afraid of that he's going to lose his a good portion of his army. Even if he takes the fort, what's going to be the cost? And that's what historians think goes through Carleton's head. Well, it didn't work out too well for the British the first time we tried to take this fort. So what makes us think that it's going to be so great this time around? So he's going to lay siege to the fort. But with winter nearing, they would be out in the open. The weather would cause issues with the supply lines. Because remember, the river is going to freeze, or at least portions of the river are going to freeze. The lakes, portions of lakes are going to freeze. They got to get all their supplies all the way down from Canada. So his belief is, let's go into winter quarters and let's bring it up next year. Because, I mean, without a fleet, they're not going to be able to build ships throughout the winter. So we can come back and we can try again in the spring. This is the move that saves the Americans because it would hold the British advance till the summer of 77, a campaign that would change the tide of the war. Though the fleet was destroyed, they would single-handedly keep the British in the north for another winter, which would give Schuyler time to consolidate his forces and prepare for the British invasion. And no, I'm not talking about the Beatles. And so that's where we're going to leave it today. This is it for the Battle of the Valcour Island campaign. The next time we talk about the Americans in the north, it's going to be in the summer of 77. That's going to be a little while away, probably sometime after the new year, because our next stop on the tour is to end the campaign season of 1776 with one of the most daring raids. I call it one of the most daring raids of the American Revolution. And that's when Washington attacks a portion of Howe's army at Trenton and Princeton. And so that's where we're going to leave it for this week or this episode. Like I said, I'm going to get that portion of the campaign hopefully started and posted by this weekend because I want to make up for missing an episode last week. I want to thank everyone who was so excited and sent so many good things on the Facebook page about my return to podcasting. Not only was it a hard time dealing with some of the family stuff, but to be honest, sometimes when I do this, I will work for several weeks and I will put out however many episodes, 5, 10, 15. And, you know, in all that time, you know, you're putting all those episodes together and then you got to record them and all that stuff. Sometime I just need a little break. And that was what I did. My plan is now, with my busy work schedule and school schedule and everything, I'm going to do my best to make sure episodes are coming out on a weekly, if not bi-weekly, schedule. So if there isn't a new episode this week, it will be an episode the following week. It just takes time. And I'm going to try and keep that schedule up for as long as I can because I do really love doing this and I love the support that I get from you guys. So once again, thank you for everyone who put something on the Facebook page. Remember, if you're enjoying what I'm doing, please go to iTunes. If you are downloading the podcast off of iTunes, put in a 5-star rating. If you want to put in a review, you can also do that. But the 5-star rating just boosts the podcast so that more people can listen. And that's all that really does. And as always, if you have any questions, the Facebook is there. So I just want to thank everyone. And until next time, always remember, keep that powder dry.